Welcome to In Tune, a podcast exploring the benefits of music for mental health and well-being. In Tune is brought to you by the University of Global Health Equity. At the University of Global Health Equity, we believe that building bridges across sectors can radically change the way we conceptualize health and well-being, as well as how we teach and deliver healthcare around the world. This is why we created Hamnia Festival, an annual platform bringing together creative and health sectors. InTune will engage musicians, researchers, mental health practitioners, and other specialists on how music can be used to support psychological, emotional, and social well-being. I am Sarah Agatoni from the University of Global Health Equity and your host through this podcast series. What is music? Is it this? Or this? Or this? Is music something we do or something we listen to? Is music an aesthetic or physiological experience? Music is diverse. The definition of music varies with factors such as cultural and societal values, as well as the functions music plays in given contexts. Across cultures, music has a long tradition as a healing practice. In ancient Greece, fresco paintings from 4,000 years before the Common Era, showing priests playing harps, are thought to be the earliest depiction of music deployed for healing. Philosophers, including Plato and Aristotle, recognized the ability of music to heal. Elsewhere, in ancient Egypt, medical documents dating around 1,500 years before the Common Era contain incantations appealing to supernatural forces for healing. And in many other cultures around the world, music played a prominent role in healing and spiritual practices. In present times, we recognize the role of music in calming nerves, boosting mood, enhancing cognition, and more. In this episode, we explore how the understanding of music may vary with culture, with time, and with the various functions of music. We'll be speaking to Dr. Ian Cross, who teaches music and has studied music in evolutionary contexts, and to Dr. Hao Huang, an accomplished pianist who has observed musical practices in multicultural contexts. And finally, we'll be speaking to Dr. Tasha Golden, Senior Arts and Health Research Scientist at the International Arts and Mind Lab in the Brain Science Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Also guiding our thinking is Dr. Eunice Ibekwe, Associate Professor of Ethnomusicology. Dr. Ibekwe researches traditional music and lectures in the Department of Music at the Nnamdi Azikiwe University in Awka, Nigeria. Our first speaker is Dr. Ian Cross. Dr. Cross is based in the Faculty of Music at the University of Cambridge, where he is Professor and Director of the Center for Music and Science. His early work helped set the agenda for the study of music cognition. Dr. Cross has since published widely in the field of music and science. He is editor-in-chief of Sage's new music and science journal and the classical guitarist. One of our goals in this episode is to move one step closer to developing a common understanding of music, the role it plays, and how its definition and function can vary across cultures and with time. Dr. Cross, before attempting to investigate a general understanding of music, perhaps you might share with us what music has meant for you and whether your understanding and interaction with it has changed over time.
Well, it has changed considerably, I suppose. My first ever exposure to it was in the context, unusually in Western culture, of dance. My mother was a Scottish country dancer, so I grew up dancing. But I didn't actually think of it as music, because I was going to a choir and learning to play piano at the same time. And I didn't really think of dance and the, quote, music, unquote, that I was learning at the choir and at the piano as the same type of thing. I eventually gave up piano because my hands are quite small, but before I gave that up, I'd started playing guitar and went on to play classical guitar for a number of years and did a couple of performance diplomas. And it wasn't really till I started thinking about music and science and music in evolutionary terms, which means you have to think about it across cultures, that I realized that what I've been doing since I was born, I suppose, was music in the form of dance. So in that sense, my understanding of music, my personal understanding, has changed considerably over my lifetime. But for the last 30-odd years, I've really been thinking about music as encompassing dance, as being embedded in society, and as serving social functions rather than just being entertainment.
You referred to thinking of music in evolutionary terms. Many, if not most of us, tend to think of evolution as something that is common to all species. Is music something that is uniquely human?
It's probably not something that's uniquely human if you break it down into its constituent parts. But when you put them all together again as music, I suspect it is uniquely human. Many other species can do many of the things that contribute to our capacity to make music together. I'm not sure that any other species, however, does precisely what we do with music. When we listen to birdsong, for instance, what we're hearing are signals in general that have quite specific informational functions. Go away, this is mine, come and have sex with me, etc. They're very specific attempts to influence the behaviours of others. And that's much more like speech than it is like human music. But birds can produce complex patterns, complex melodies. That's part of music. A number of other species, mammalian species, can produce complex melodies. Pinnipeds, seals, for instance. One of the things that characterizes music is a regular pulse. Whether or not it is evident in the music, almost all the world's music is organized around a regular pulse that is experienced as shared between the participants who are making music together. Even if, as I say, the pulse is not phenomenally present in the music. We do it without thinking. We can pick up a pulse. We can keep time. Most other species can't. A few seem to be able to. Possibly vocal learning species. Possibly some cockatoos. Possibly a range of other species. It is also possible that some chimps can keep time with other chimps. But perhaps only with close kin. Chimps with whom they've been brought up together. Humans are extremely flexible in being able to keep time with anyone, no matter if you know them or not. If I start off a beat, you can pick it up and join in very easily. So there are aspects of music which, if you break them down, are obviously shared with other species. Music is a kind of mosaic in evolutionary terms. Little bits of it are evident in the behaviours of other species. But I suspect that it's only humans for whom music is fully functional and fully present.
So while some aspects of music, like the ability to engage with and anticipate a beat, could be uniquely human, other species can make complex and purposeful sounds. Narrowing our scope to human beings, do people generally share a common understanding of what music is?
Across cultures and societies, music tends to be something that people do together, something that people do multimodally. We don't just make the sounds, we move around, we dance, probably, at the same time. That's common in most world cultures. It's only in the last, I don't know, maybe 1,000 years of Western musical traditions that a dominant idea of music being something that you simply listen to has emerged. Across the rest of the globe, music is something that we do together. It's not particularly specialist. And it tends to happen at times and in places where societies and cultures need it, often in situations of social uncertainty, situations where things are changing, social structures are changing. So, for instance, births, deaths, marriages, changes of social status, as in initiations, into a different state within the society. In all these contexts, music is part of the process that accompanies them, that renders the uncertainty a little less intense, that enables us to get on with living, get on with each other in particular.
And so one of the functions of music is supporting social transitions, reducing uncertainty within changing social structures. What other functions might music have, particularly in a mental health context?
It's being increasingly recognized that music can provide an extremely good, low-cost, reliable way of enhancing mental health in the context of social integration. When we engage in music together, we feel connected to each other. It's one of the things that humans seem to need to do. Take the example of a group of football fans at a football match. Typically, they'll sing, and they'll sing together. Why are they doing this? Two reasons. It builds a sense of group identity. It makes each person singing feel that they are part of a larger group. But it also projects a sense of that group's identity against the fans of the other team. So there's a kind of competitive aspect to it in that particular institutional context, the football match. In another context, let us say a period of national mourning, let's say after 9/11 in the USA, a particular piece of music, Samuel Barber's Adagio, was played on most broadcast stations for a great deal of the time. It's a very mournful, melancholic, but very beautiful piece, and it seemed to bring the nation together at a time of fracture. Music, in other words, can serve to build group identity and sustain group identity.
So we've looked at music from an evolutionary perspective, which suggests that aspects of music may be uniquely human, while others are shared among species. We've observed that some cultures have more participatory styles of music than others. We've also looked at what is often cited as the primary function of music, sustaining identity and connectedness. Can we now arrive at a working definition of what music is?
I would say yes, but my definition of music wouldn't seem much like music to many people. I suspect that music is an affiliative, communicative medium, which is not unimodal, it's not limited to sound alone, it's evident in our actions as well as in the sounds that we make. And it serves a number of different functions, but it is primarily a way of getting on with other people.
Our next guest, Dr. Hao Huang, is the Bessie and Cecil Frankel Endowed Chair in Music at Scripps College. Dr. Huang is an accomplished pianist who has received critical acclaim in over 24 countries in Asia, Europe, and North America. His scholarship of music spans piano pedagogy, general music studies, popular music, ethnomusicology, jazz, anthropology, American studies, and humanities. Dr. Huang's scholarly work has been recognized by the Chronicle of Higher Education, The Washington Post, and National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Dr. Huang, to start us off, please share with us your background with music. How did you get started?
I started my life in music simply by playing the piano. I was a very active child, and after I had broken nearly every toy my parents had bought me, at the age of about 5.5 or 6, my mother turned to a upright piano because, as she told me then, this was something I could not break. And she was right. I didn't break it. And in fact, I loved it. The moment I touched the piano, I loved the sound. It just made me feel wonderful to listen to it. And I started learning the piano when I was 5.5. And by the time I was 9, I was already what I call a normal child prodigy. I was very active. I won, you know, some competitions and gave some concerts. And the funny thing was that I did not really think about a career in music seriously. Even when I went to college, a number of my teachers automatically thought I would go to Juilliard. But in fact, I did what I call my typical Asian American rebellion. And I was lucky enough to be accepted to Harvard. And I started my career at Harvard. And I'm really grateful for going there because I learned to marry my love for music with the ability to think. And that is something that really has steered my life since then. So, yeah, in a nutshell, that's my involvement in music.
Right. And how or why did you pivot from performing to studying music?
I pivoted first from performing to teaching, and then from teaching to scholarship. And I would say what's common to everything is to share my love of music. When you perform, you are trying to share the deepest knowledge and love for how the music goes, at least to you. And you don't hold back in any way, emotionally or artistically. And you need to be focused. You need to be there in the moment, because your goal actually is to become the music, not only to play at the music. And then in teaching, it's kind of the same thing. When I'm working with a student, we're working together to try to understand music in new ways, in different ways, because after all, I don't want my student to be playing this music the same way that I would. As I tell my students, if I want to hear the music the way I play it, I don't need my students to do it that way. I can play it myself. So I'm more interested in finding out how students can find their own individual path in music. And of course, it has to do with self-expression, but it also has to do with cultural knowledge and with thought, with trying to understand, what is this music about? Where did it come from? What does it try to express? What's its motivation? And then you can see that in scholarship, it's very much the same thing. We try to understand different topics, different subjects, and provide, hopefully, insights and our own interpretations and analyses of what we're looking at, what we're writing about.
As a pianist, you're well-versed in Western classical music, but you've studied music in various cultures. What inspires this diversity, this exploration?
Every culture has its own kind of music, and that is what's so fascinating to me. It's like deciding to go to a bed of many diverse flowers instead of going to one, maybe rose garden, but looking at all the wonderful different species of music or listening to that. And I've found in my work with Native American music, but also in the Hmong hill tribes of northern Thailand, in the rock and roll of mainland China, in jazz and blues in the United States, and black gospel music, in Roma gypsy music in Hungary, in Hawaiian hula music. I've found that these fundamental things, in terms of holding people together as a culture, of creating collective identities, of promoting rituals where a public collaborates in witnessing and experiencing something communally, that is something that is common, I think, to most cultures in the world.
You mentioned the role of music in promoting rituals, which brings to mind sporting events where we sing national anthems or even religious holidays that tend to be accompanied by music. Speaking generally, what are rituals for? What purpose do they serve?
Rituals have diverse purposes. Sometimes it's spiritual, sometimes it's communal. Solitary music making for personal pleasure can become something that's isolating. And even so, I would say most individual performers often practice with an imaginary audience in mind. So non-Western cultures often value music as a ceremonial practice, but it also, I think, tells narratives that matter to a community. I would say that one of the important rituals, ritualistic uses of music has to do with shamanic or traditional healing practices. What is common in almost all of the practices, shamanic practices that pertain to music, is the constant repetition of a consistent drum beat that resonates with a heart rhythm that can lead to trance. And this kind of musical trance, I believe, can help people experience their bodies and their senses completely in the present. It takes over your consciousness. But it also allows people to let complicated thoughts, the things that we ruminate on, the things which disturb us, to flow away from this consciousness because we're focused on the music. And even a scholar like McNiff suggests that the most fundamental task is keeping a steady rhythmic pulse. The shamanic drumming demands endurance, lasting power, discipline, and submission to a continuing rhythm. So we can think of the rhythm itself as a primary healer. Now, for both Hmong shamans and Native American shamans, some of the most sacred chants that they use in healing practices are in ritual languages that currently have no specific meanings for any people in their societies. Not even the shamans themselves know what those words mean, but the meanings are implicit because they are contained in the purpose of the chant. And that's more powerful than any individual word meanings would be. Music can transform the way we look at mental illness. So mental illness is not treated as a pathology, but as an opportunity for sensitive people who are afflicted by mental and spiritual disturbances to use their energies through ritual and music to not only heal themselves, but to heal others. Rather than being treated as broken, abnormal people who can't conform to conventional social behaviors, in my experience, many shamans have been trained and supported to become healers in their own communities.
We've seen that music is diverse in its functions, among them underlining ritual and healing practices to the benefit of the community and of healers who are sometimes individuals at risk for ostracization, for being socially unconventional, or themselves mentally afflicted. This unifying aspect of music seems common to most cultures. As Dr. Ibekwe notes, in many cultures where societal values are prominent, music is construed as a communion, a binding force. Knowing this, Dr. Wang, are we now able to define music in a way that accounts for the commonalities and differences across cultures? What is music?
I'd start with saying music is a neuropsychological response to the physical act of sound vibrations. And any work of music can feature specific tonal and rhythmic patterns that are based on physical and formal structures. I think that music, all in all, has been part of the fabric of everyday life, of the way we experience life in most cultures. And there is evidence throughout history, most of human history, that music making was as regular an activity like breathing or dancing, and that everyone in the community participated. So as a performer, I value the making of music more than trying to pin down a prescriptive definition of what it is. And I would say that there's both common understandings and different understandings of music in different societies. Any kind of common understanding of artistic work is going to have to do with shared goals, shared values, shared activity. And I'd argue that an audience listening to a performer of any kind of music arrives at a common understanding that the music is worth paying attention to. And the performer who plays that music for an audience feels that the music is worth performing and sharing with others.
Dr. Wang establishes that music has a long history of being incorporated into healing rituals. We now shift into contemporary healing practices with Dr. Tasha Golden. Dr. Golden is Director of Research and Senior Arts and Health Research Scientist at the International Arts and Mind Lab in the Brain Science Institute at Johns Hopkins University. She studies the impacts of arts, culture, environments, and discourses on health, equity, research, and clinical practice. Dr. Golden is also the singer-songwriter for the critically acclaimed band Ellery and founder of Project Uncaged, a trauma-informed, arts-based health intervention for incarcerated teen women. When we spoke, Dr. Golden was wrapping up a scoping review of the uses of music in treating or mitigating the symptoms for serious mental illness. Dr. Golden, can you share with us the details of the scoping review?
Yes, the International Arts and Mind Lab at Johns Hopkins has collaborated with a philanthropic organization called One Mind in the U.S. to develop a scoping review of the uses of music in treating or mitigating the symptoms of serious mental illness. And for the purpose of this review, we defined serious mental illness by 5 diagnoses, and those included post-traumatic stress disorder, major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. And so we did a comprehensive global search looking for how music was used, not necessarily to research those diagnoses, although it has been used in many ways for that purpose, which is interesting. But we were specifically looking at how it has been used to either treat or mitigate symptoms related to those diagnoses. And we first had nearly 12,000 results that we had to comb through. Through an intensive review process and screening process with our inclusion criteria, and eventually wound up with 349 studies that we then looked at a little bit more in depth to be able to get an idea of just what is happening in this general landscape of music and mental illness.
What were some of the findings? Are music-based interventions effective?
This scoping review did find that over 2/3 of the studies reported that the music-based intervention that was being studied performed better than the comparator. And the comparator could be multiple things. The comparator sometimes was the participant before having gone through the music experience and after. So if they were better after than before, then that was reported as a positive outcome. But it could also be comparing the music-based intervention to what we would call treatment as usual or standard conventional care. Sometimes the music-based intervention was being compared to another alternative therapy, such as yoga or meditation. Sometimes the music-based intervention was being compared to just a different type of music, a different genre of music. But all of that said, the comparators were very different, but 2/3 of the studies indicated that the intervention performed better than the comparator. 12% of the studies were undetermined. They weren't able to report whether the intervention under study was better or worse. And just under 3% reported that the music-based intervention was worse than the comparator.
And I wonder what their challenges or limitations particular to this review.
I will say that a significant limitation of the scoping review is that we excluded studies that were not in English or available with an English translation. So we wound up with a great deal of studies that were located in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Australia, New Zealand. And then there were a few studies that were left out because we just couldn't get our hands on them due to some COVID-19 closures of libraries and things like that. And so it is likely that there are studies that we missed that would have provided some differing results or some nuance that wasn't included due to that exclusion criteria in our search. On the other hand, our sample size was large enough to where some of the more crucial findings of the scoping review, they would be unlikely to be changed by the addition of other studies. And by that, I mean the finding that in general, reporting strategies are so different from discipline to discipline, study to study, that it makes it difficult for us to synthesize findings. There was a great deal of heterogeneity, which is just to say that the studies, while they were incorporating music to treat or mitigate symptoms related to these 5 diagnoses, they were doing it in myriad ways that couldn't always be compared or even effectively contrasted. But then also, we don't have enough information from those studies about things like, did the person choose to do this music-based activity, or was this really kind of pushed on them by a therapist or a doctor? If they did choose it, how many other things were they able to choose from? Did they have options like talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, maybe yoga, maybe meditation, and then music, and they chose music? Because a sense of autonomy, we know, can affect outcomes. 3/4 of the studies failed to report race or ethnicity at all, and those that did report it didn't necessarily break down. They might just say that this was mixed race study without telling us who was included in that, which just makes it difficult to know for whom music has been effective, among whom has music been studied. Is there a difference in genre or approaches by culture or by background or socioeconomic background or age. All of these demographic factors that have been inconsistently reported that just prevent us from knowing a bit more about, like I said, for whom are these treatments or approaches or interventions effective, and when, in what kinds of settings, in what stage of their illness, those kinds of details that are often missing.
Despite these important limitations, that two-thirds of the studies you reviewed reported a positive outcome seems promising. Are we now able to say that music is definitely effective as an intervention for serious mental illness?
As a scientist, I will say a scoping review, it differs from a systematic review in research in that a scoping review does not entail a critical appraisal of the study. So we don't look at each study that's included in the review to discern if there's bias or this quality of the study. So we are really kind of relegated to what the study itself reported. We did not investigate each study's quality to discern whether we would agree if their finding is actually derivable from their study. But with that said, it is definitely promising that music has consistently had these positive results. It definitely indicates that we should continue to conduct some research. And what we are proposing in our scoping review is if we can continue to do this type of research with better reporting practices, then researchers in the future will be better able to synthesize these findings and really move the field forward, because it does obviously appear to be a promising area of study, particularly because there are not the side effects and adverse effects that you might see with pharmacological interventions or other types of interventions.
And I wonder, what are some of the implications of the current state of evidence? Just how far do you think we are from having something like music therapy incorporated as a traditional healthcare practice in most places?
My training is in public health, and from a public health perspective, there are health promoting and health beneficial behaviors and activities that the world has been able to advance and raise awareness about without necessarily the threshold of evidence that we might hold a pharmaceutical solution to, or even some physical therapies. So we have different levels of evidence that seem to be required for when we suggest or recommend certain kinds of activities to a general public to say, this might be good for you. Which is just to say that it's possible to recommend to a public based on one level of evidence that this could be good for you. If you're feeling down, for example, you might seek out some music that makes you feel good and play that. And you can make that recommendation with some confidence. On the other hand, if somebody has a diagnosis of major depressive disorder and you're their physician or their psychologist or therapist, the level of evidence that you might need to say this will help your progress, and we might choose to actually invest some of our time in music as opposed to prescribing an antidepressant or as opposed to continuing with cognitive behavioral therapy or something else, then for sure, at that level, you're going to need a different threshold of evidence. And I think that that's what people have been working toward with music therapy and with this more general concept of how music can be used in the treatment or mitigation of symptoms with serious mental illness, even if it's not quote unquote music therapy. A lot of times people in conversations with me have assumed that there is a lack of evidence and a lack of studies. What we're seeing with the scoping review is that there's clearly a lot of studies being conducted. And the predominant study design that we found was randomized control trials, which is often what people perceive as being what is needed to produce rigorous evidence in order to move us to a potentially a prescription mode or a social prescribing scenario. So what we're finding is that actually there are a lot of RCTs, randomized control trials, being conducted, and tons of studies of how music might affect serious mental illness. What we lack is an ability to synthesize all this together to be able to present that evidence in a systematized, aggregated way. So how far we are from being able to meet that threshold, I think it depends on our ability as a multidisciplinary field to either go back to existing studies and re-report them to add the details that are currently missing or precluding our synthesis, or our ability in the future to really get all of the myriad people who are involved in this work to come together and report on what they're doing in a way that everybody from different fields can recognize and understand and aggregate.
Dr. Golden and her team found that in two-thirds of the studies reviewed, music performed better than comparators including treatment as usual, and alternative therapies such as yoga and meditation. These studies point to the effectiveness of music as a contemporary healing practice. Arriving at the end of our conversations, we're able to stitch together a snapshot of what music might be. Dr. Ian Cross calls it an affiliative communicative medium, which is not unimodal. It can be piano, it can be drumming, it can be dance. It often brings people together. This function is reflected in Dr. Huang's study of music as a support for ritualistic and healing practices. All three recognize that music in practice may not need to be understood to be made or enjoyed, but that standardization brings us one step closer to synthesizing evidence for what we might already think, that music can help us to live better, in our heads and in our communities. A great thanks to you for listening in, and a big thanks to Dr. Tasha Golden, Dr. Hao Huang, Dr. Ian Cross, and Dr. Eunice Ibekwe. Stay tuned for more episodes in this series where we talk to musicians, researchers, and mental health practitioners on how music can be used to support psychological, emotional, and social well-being.